I'm Gary Musk, and this is the Progressive Commentary. Today, we are talking about Israel's weapons laboratory and technologies and their employment in the United States. They're very big today in the intelligence agencies. Why? What are the concerns we should have? I have two guests. My first guest in Beirut is Rania Kalik. She is a Lebanese-American independent investigative journalist who has written for progressive publications like The Intercept, The Nation, Truthout, Al Jazeera, Vice, and others. Earlier, she served as an associate editor of the pro-Palestinian news site Electronic Intifada, where she remains a regular contributor and a member of its board. She's also been a regular contributor to the media watchdog Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. And Rania is co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And her website is Rania, R-A-N-I-A, Kalik, K-H-A-L-E-K.com. After that, we will go to our second guest for a longer segment. And he is Anthony Lowenstein. Now, Anthony will be speaking with us from Israel. He is an Israeli-based Australian independent journalist. He is a documentarian, and he writes a column for The Guardian in the United Kingdom, and his articles have appeared in all the major alternative publications, The New York Times, The Nation, Haaretz in Israel, The Australian, Foreign Policy, Electronic Intifada, Tycoon, and others. And over the years, he has reported from Israel, Pakistan, Haiti, Papua New Guinea, and he's written several controversial and best-selling books on Israel and Zionism, and the political right, and vulture capitalism, and in the environment. His documentary, A Different Kind of Jew, was a finalist in the United Nations Media Peace Award. Anthony's latest book is the controversially acclaimed My Israel Question, and he is also the author of a very important investigative report into the new corporate order of world governance today, called Disaster Capitalism, Making a Killing Out of Catastrophe, which is being made into a movie. His website is anthonylowenstein.com. Now, earlier today, we reached out to my first guest to be able to get her on, but she is in a different time zone. So we have selected an interview with Chris Hedges. And, of course, everyone in this audience knows Chris. He's simply one of our finest investigative journalists. And Chris Hedges, for RT Television, did an interview with her. We'll give you some of his interview with her, and then we'll give you a short interview that she did by herself. And then from that, we'll take a break and go to our second guest. Now to Rania.
Israel is a tiny country with a population of just 8.5 million, yet it ranks among the top arms exporters in the world. How did that happen? Well, it's no secret that Palestine is the site of grave human rights violations by Israel. But it's about more than just Palestine. What Israel does to Palestinians has far-reaching consequences that touch every corner of the globe. You see, on top of being occupied, colonized territory, Palestine is Israel's personal laboratory for testing, refining, and showcasing methods and weapons of domination and control. Easy access to a captive and disenfranchised Palestinian population to experiment on has given rise to a booming homeland security industry in Israel that repackages occupation-style repression for use on marginalized populations in other parts of the world. It allows Israeli arms producers to market their products as battle-tested and combat-proven, coveted labels that give Israel a competitive edge in the international arms trade. This has been especially lucrative for Israel in the post-9/11 era. Israeli arms sales have risen from $2 billion annually in 2002 to over $9 billion in 2017. The most extreme version of the laboratory dynamic is the Gaza Strip, which functions as an open-air testing ground for weapons of mass destruction. Gaza is home to nearly 2 million Palestinians, many of them refugees and the descendants of refugees who were forced out of their homes in 1948. Gaza is basically an open-air prison surrounded by an air, sea, and land blockade. This makes it a convenient laboratory for Israel's most destructive weapons. In the summer of 2014, Israel launched a brutal 51-day bombing campaign in Gaza that killed over 2,000 Palestinians, including more than 500 children. Less than a month after the massacre, Israel held its annual drone expo featuring many systems that had been used for the first time during the 2014 Gaza onslaught.
This was used with our systems. That video was taken by this system right here. So it works. Yeah. our system have been proven. We call it battlefield proven.
Proven. So there's like a lot of pride in that statement.
There is, sure.
Elbit Systems is Israel's largest military technology firm and one of Israel's leading producers of drones. Israeli military firms like Elbit use each new war on Gaza as an opportunity to expedite the testing and release of their weapons in front of international buyers. This has helped make Israel the world's number one exporter in drone technology. Since 1985, Israel has supplied 60.7% of the world's drones to at least 50 different countries. That's quite an achievement for a country no bigger than New Jersey. It's the same pattern with Israeli border technology. In 2014, Elbit Systems won a $145 million contract to build a virtual wall of surveillance towers along the Arizona-Mexico border, the same sort of technology used at the illegal separation wall Israel built in the West Bank. Trump has since tapped an Israeli company to build a prototype for the border wall he hopes to build. It's not just Israeli equipment that's exported around the world, but also Israeli methods. Under the cover of counterterrorism training, nearly every major U.S. policing agency, from local police departments to ICE to the FBI, has traveled to Israel for lessons in occupation enforcement, crowd control, use of force, media spin, and Islamic fundamentalism. These police exchanges are organized by pro-Israel groups like the Anti-Defamation League and the American Jewish Committee's Project Interchange. The police officers who participate are taking the lessons they learned in Israel back to the United States, according to the ADL. And there are concrete examples of them doing just that. The NYPD's demographic unit that used to spy on Muslims was modeled in part on how Israeli authorities operate in the occupied West Bank. New York Mayor Bill de Blasio may have disbanded the unit, but the NYPD relationship with Israel is still running strong, so strong that the Israeli NYPD has a branch stationed in Israel. 3 months after Ferguson, Missouri erupted in protests in response to the police killing of Michael Brown, the St. Louis Police Department began stockpiling skunk spray. Skunk spray is a foul-smelling liquid developed by the Israeli police, and it's sprayed exclusively on Palestinian protesters, and sometimes on entire Palestinian neighborhoods. It emits a foul stench that has been described as a mix between rotting animal corpse, raw sewage, and feces. And the odor sticks to walls, clothing, hair, and skin for days and is impossible to wash away. Skunk spray hasn't been used on U.S. soil yet, but other U.S. police departments are trying to get their hands on it. Deadly and racist police violence in the U.S. is bad enough as it is. Adding Israeli-style repression to that already dangerous mix will only make things worse. That's why activists are pushing for an end to U.S.-Israeli police collaboration. Here's how the former mayor of Atlanta, Georgia, responded to their demands.
But I happen to believe that the Israeli Police Department has some of the best counterterrorism techniques in the world, and it benefits our police department from that long-standing relationship.
Activists in Durham, North Carolina, had more success.
In recent weeks, a petition has been circulating in Durham asking the city council to condemn those police exchanges. Tonight, the group behind the petition is claiming victory.
Durham has become the first city in the U.S. to ban police exchanges in Israel. And activists in other parts of the country plan to push for similar measures. But in the meantime, as long as Israel's economy is shaped by the subjugation of Palestinians, it will continue to function as a factory for cutting-edge repression technology that sustains and reinforces racism, inequality, and war around the globe. In many ways, what Israel does to Palestinians is a glimpse into the future of what's to come for the most vulnerable and marginalized among us, from the killing fields of Gaza to the tear gas streets of Ferguson and beyond, which makes the battle for justice in Palestine a global one.
This has been a gift to the Israeli security or arms establishment. And one of the things you've written extensively about is how, as we have militarized our police forces, Israeli tactics and even Israeli weapons have infiltrated into the streets of places like Ferguson.
Yeah, so since 9/11, virtually every major U.S. police department and many small ones have
that. 200, right?
Yeah, that's an estimate. Like, right. We actually don't even know, but many police departments across the country have sent senior level commanders to Israel on trips to basically train with the Israeli military, Israeli border police, Israeli, you know, national police, to meet with Mossad agents, to receive briefings. And they end up adopting some of what they learn and bringing it back to the United States. And these trips are facilitated oftentimes by organizations like the ADL and AIPAC.
These are Israeli lobby groups.
Right, exactly. Right. Exactly. There's, I mean, the relationships are so close to the point where, and this fit in really well with the idea of the war on terror in this country. And you mentioned, you know, the militarization of police. Israel's role in helping perpetuate that, obviously it's not the sole reason behind the militarization of police, but its role is virtually ignored in the mainstream press. But it's happening. I mean, all the time you see these press releases out about Israeli, about, you know, several U.S. police departments sending their police chiefs to Israel, and they bring what they learned back. And there are a couple examples of this. In New York City, there was the demographics unit, and that was largely influenced and modeled off of the way that Israel treats Palestinians in the West Bank.
Great. So we were speaking about these police chiefs, police officials who go to Israel for training, bring back Israeli tactics to the streets of American cities. But you've also written that there's an ideological component. What is that?
So when you have police officers, a civilian police force, going to a country like Israel to learn from their military how to occupy people, that's what they're going to learn. That's what the Israeli military does.
That's what they do in our inner cities with poor people of color, of course.
Well, exactly. And they're basically bringing that mentality back with them and applying it here. And so Palestinians are these people who are basically, I mean, it's Israel. So a part of it is also trying to sell the occupation as really a law and order issue. So Palestinians aren't occupied people. Right? They're just a bunch of criminals that need to be controlled and that need to like have law and order imposed on them. And at the same time, you have U.S. police officers coming back to this country, A, thinking Zionism's great, and then B, also applying tactics of occupation to poor populations that they already, you know, use these tactics on, but now it's in a more efficient way because Israel does have a very efficient system of control. And so that's a part of it. A part of it is just kind of churning out pro-Israel supporters within the police departments in this country.
And it's been quite effective cities like Atlanta.
And especially in New York City. I mean, New York City probably has one of the closest relationships, as well as in L.A., the LAPD and Israel are best buddies. But then there's also ways they're bringing these back. So I mentioned the demographics unit in New York City. And then there's also a more recent example is the St. Louis Police Department. 3 months after the Ferguson uprising took place, the St. Louis Police Department, which has also sent people to Israel before, started stockpiling skunk spray.
Explain what that is.
So skunk spray is this liquid crowd control mechanism that is sprayed on people in Palestine. It's only ever been used on Palestinians, and it smells awful. It smells like rotting animal flesh and human feces and a number of other awful things. And it sticks to your skin and your hair and the odor and your walls, because sometimes Israel will spray it on homes. It sticks to that for days. You can't wash it off. You can't scrub it off. So basically, it's in a way, it's humiliating, but Israel it was developed by the Israeli police department, and so a lot of times on these police department trips, when they go to Israel, it also offers a free marketing opportunity to Israeli companies to sell their products to U.S. police departments. And with skunk spray, which has still not been used on American streets, there are other police departments that have also suggested they're interested in procuring it. Perhaps they already have. And so at some point, you know, you shouldn't be surprised if you see it used against protesters in some inner city.
Let us now go by Skype to Israel, where standing by is Anthony Lowenstein. Anthony is an Israeli-based Australian independent journalist, an author, and documentarian. He writes a column for The Guardian in the United Kingdom, and his articles have appeared in all the major alternative publications, including The New York Times, The Nation, Haaretz in Israel, The Australian, Foreign Policy, Electronic Intifada, Tycoon, and many others. And over the years, he has reported from Israel and Pakistan and Haiti and Papua New Guinea, and he's written several controversial and best-selling books on Israel and Zionism, The Political Right, Vulture Capitalism, and the Environment. His documentary, A Different Kind of Jew, was a finalist for the UN Peace Award, and Anthony's latest book is the controversially acclaimed My Israel Question. And he is also the author of a very important investigation into the new corporate order of the world governance today, Disaster Capitalism, Making a Killing Out of Catastrophe, which is being made into a movie. We're happy to hear that. His website is antonyloewenstein.com. And I spell these because we're heard all over the world. We're the number one progressive radio program in the world, coming from the number one progressive station. And people in other countries don't always have English as their first language. So I do that out of respect for them so they can hear it. Nice to have you back with us today.
Thanks for having me. How are you?
Good. As a coincidence to your interview today, I just read Robert Fisk's new article in The Independent, just out today. And it says, Why American figures like Michelle Alexandra are breaking their silence on Israel. And before we get to you, I just want to read a couple of paragraphs here. I think our audience would appreciate this because most of the people in the world don't know who Michelle Alexandra is and don't know her background. So here's what she has to say. This is from Robert Fisk. Until this month, most Americans won't have heard of Michelle Alexander. She's a civil rights lawyer, an academic, and has written a book called The New Jim Crow. And a few months ago, the New York Times took her on as a regular columnist. And like millions of black and white Americans, she is a devotee of Martin Luther King Jr. And last week, she began an op-ed in the Old Gray Lady, the New York Times of record, and one time a conservative with a long and admiring tribute to the black Christian and nonviolent civil rights campaigner who just a year before his 1968 assassination decided he must speak out about the disaster of the Vietnam War. He had been told to soft pedal the conflict, which had been at that time costing at least 10,000 American lives, but which was still supported by the political establishment. So even though he would be falsely accused of being a communist, he chose to break his silence. So far, so good. But last week, Alexander chose to break her own silence, not about racism in the United States or about second-class citizenship or Trump, but about Palestinians. Whoops. And for not only did she reiterate King's belief that Israel must return parts of its then newly conquered territories, East Jerusalem, the West Bank, Gaza, and Golan, but she launched into a long, eloquent, rather patronizing, self-indulgent, but courageous condemnation of Israel's outrageous treatment of Palestinians. Like King, she had been silent on, quote, one of the great moral challenges of our time, end quote, along with U.S. Congress, civil rights activists, and students. But further silence on Israel and the Palestinians she decided would be, quote, betrayal. If they had been wise, Israel's friends, supporters, and lobbyists in America might have held their peace. After the election of a man named Omar to Congress, supporting the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign against Israel, the state's commander-in-chief might have dismissed Alexander as a hitherto respected scholar who had tried to advance her social status by adopting the Palestinian cause in King's shadow with neither the knowledge nor the political support to sustain her. But no, the sky fell. She was, quote, vicious in her views, wrong on facts, potentially anti-Semitic, a, quote, strategic threat to Israel itself. Her article was, quote, dangerously flawed or, quote, error-ridden rant, end quote, that ignored Palestinian violence and terrorism. It was a sign of just how shaken Israel's friends had become in an America that is breaking the old taboo of a U.S.-Israeli relations and Washington's permanent acquiescence to Israel's illegal colonization of Arab land. And then it goes on from there for another three pages. I commend Michelle Alexander. I commend Glenn Ford and Naley Bailey. I commend Bruce Dixon. These are all African Americans who have very independent and progressive views concerning our body politic and the world we live in. They're never quoted. They're never invited on any program because, indeed, they are not compromisers to the truth. They are extremely brilliant intellects and activists. And the last thing the American media, left especially or right, wants is someone who can deconstruct their own arguments. That said, we now have a guest who has done even more to bring the truth about Israel to our attention than almost any other journalist I know of. There are at least three who have the courage to do so, but you're talking about a handful. And no one condemns Israel for all the things it's done wrong. I did an hour special just last week on the USS Liberty, where the United States President Lyndon Johnson commanded that that Israeli planes, along with the Israeli defense minister and prime minister, sink the ship and then blame it on Israel and then launch an attack by the U.S. Fleet in that area against Egypt. The media didn't touch it. Why? To my guest now, since it is almost no natural resources in abundance enough for export, the majority of its international economy is based upon the export of cut diamonds, which makes up 23% of its exports, pharmaceutical drugs and medical devices, and integrated circuits, which includes computers and cell phones. And now, as you have investigated, we might add intelligence, spy and surveillance technology, including drones. So please begin by sharing what some of these technologies are and elaborate on Israel's marketing strategy for selling these products as being battle-tested, meaning they have been used on Palestinians over the years to prove their efficacy. In other words, these technologies are being sold with the promise that they can control a population. So please expand upon that also and share how they have been used to control Gaza and the West Bank. The forum is yours.
Thank you. So Israel has been occupying Palestinian territory for over 50 years. In 1967, there was a Six-Day War. Many listeners will be aware of that history. I won't go into detail about it now, but suffice to say, Israel has been occupying the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem for over 50 years. And in that time, Israel's perfected, to some extent, the art of controlling the Palestinian population. And how have they done that? Through a variety of means. Obviously, through constant wars and occupation, which means that countless Palestinians, men, women, and children have been imprisoned, tortured, kept often for years behind bars for spurious reasons. But technologically speaking, they have perfected the art of using walls, drones, sensors, various other technologies, especially in the last 10, 15 years. And even more so since Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, came into power about a decade ago. One of his goals, and he states this publicly, regularly, is to sell this technology to the world. Now, what does that mean practically? It means that various nations, often dictatorships, but also nominal democracies, like the idea that they can get technology that can help them manage, control, occupy various populations in their own country. So a few examples. Listeners will be aware a few months ago that the Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi was murdered in the Istanbul Turkish consulate by the Saudis. And it now becomes clear that one of the ways in which the Saudis knew what he was going to be doing, when he was going to be going to that consulate and what his general movements were, was because the Saudis had purchased from the Israelis surveillance technology from a company called NSO Group, which is based here in Israel, sold it to the Saudis. One of Jamal Khashoggi's colleagues, friends in Canada, his phone had been hacked. Their WhatsApp messages had been read, and essentially the Saudis knew what Khashoggi was going to be doing. Now, we know this for a few reasons. One, because those WhatsApp messages have been leaked to the media. Two, this Saudi dissident in Canada is now suing the Israeli company in an Israeli court, claiming that this company is breaching human rights. And that's one case amongst so many others. And I had a recent story, listeners might be interested, in the New York Review of Books, really investigating how Israel has perfected this technology. And it's worth saying that although the US is by far the world's biggest seller of defense equipment, intelligence equipment, and surveillance equipment, by far, often the second in intelligence and surveillance equipment is Israel. And one of the things I think that worries a lot of people in the human rights space and just people in general who care about these issues is that what Israel has done through its occupation for many years is to, as you said in your introduction, use the term battle-tested. What does that mean? That means, for example, in the last 6 months, there has been a number of protests on the Gaza border. Some listeners will be aware of this. Hundreds of Palestinians have been killed, shot dead, civilians, by the Israeli army. And Israel has deployed various technologies, including drones and other equipment, to monitor the situation. In fact, there's one new drone called the Sea of Tears. That's literally what it's called, which drops tear gas on individuals and, of course, makes people cough and splutter. Now, when it was known that this technology and drone was available, countless people around the world, governments particularly, wanted to buy it. The company that has built the wall and the fence that Israel has built around the Gaza Strip is an Israeli company. That company is, for example, bidding on the possibility of building some of Donald Trump's possible wall on the Mexican border. And there's a range of other examples of this. My piece goes into more detail. So this is kind of a brief outline of how Israel is selling the experience of occupation to the world.
I appreciate that overview. Thank you. One disturbing trend are the countries purchasing these technologies, notably very corrupt regimes like Saudi Arabia and the Philippines and Chad, even Myanmar. I'm sure Brazil's Bolsonaro will be one of the next big clients. Clearly, any ethics or morality for who and who should not possess these products is being ignored. Seemingly, anyone willing to pay the price can gain possession of these surveillance tools. If this is the case, then does Israel have another political motivation for exporting the spy equipment to improve its low standing in the world?
I think the answer to that is partly yes. And, for example, in the last few years, the Israeli government has made it a real commitment to try to become friends with many countries in Africa, including very, very corrupt ones, the Ivory Coast, Chad. They're even talking potentially behind the scenes about Sudan, which is deeply ironic because the International Criminal Court has an indictment against Bashir, the leader of Sudan, for alleged genocide in Darfur. So the idea that Israel would want to befriend these kind of countries really speaks for itself. But the question is why? Yes, these countries themselves, you can see from their perspective why they'd want to. They obviously can get this amazing equipment to monitor dissidents in their own country. And we've seen vast evidence that many countries, in fact, are using Israeli equipment to monitor dissidents, critics, etc. But from the Israeli perspective, it's not just making money, but although that's obviously part of it, it's also, as you say, to try to improve its position within the UN. Whenever there's a United Nations vote on issues around Israel, it's generally speaking the vast bulk of the world on one side, essentially saying occupation's wrong, a Gaza incursion is wrong, whatever the issue may be. And on the other side of the vote is a handful of countries, the US, of course, Israel, sometimes small nations that are essentially client states of Israel, the US, so Micronesia, Palau, Nauru. And sadly, as an Australian citizen myself, often Australia in the last years is often also on the side of the US and Israel, shamefully. But generally speaking, most of the world's on the other side. So ultimately, I think Israel has two goals, yes, to make money, yes, to get influence, but also to try to improve its international standing. The question is that actually working? And as I say in my recent essay in the New York Review of Books, on the one hand, defense industries are never ethical. So it's not as if Israel is on one level unique in that. The US arms industry, the French arms industry also sells weapons and technology to the worst regimes in the world. Let's be obvious and let's be clear about that. But I guess the difference is with the Israeli situation is that a very, very small country with on one level not a great deal of power on one hand has essentially leveraging its decades and decades of experience with occupation and sells that as a point of positivity, arguing this is what you can do with your own population. And that on the one hand seems to be working to an extent, But increasingly, other nations are also doing the same kind of thing. For example, in the last few years, the Russians, who have been obviously very influential in Syria, they were one of the key players to ensure that President Assad there has essentially won that civil war. And Russia is now going around to arms fairs, weapons sales around the world, saying we have technology which is battle-tested in Syria. So it's not just Israel that's doing this, but the scale of what Israel is doing, I think, is unique. And I think that's why, in some ways, it's a bit of an Achilles heel, because many critics increasingly of Israel will say two things. One, why should company X or company Y from Israel not be targeted or boycotted for selling this equipment to repressive regimes and also repressing Palestinians? But many people also might say, well, hang on a minute. Yes, you have occupied the Palestinians for over 50 years, but the Palestinians are not defeated. They're still around. They're still alive. They're still here in Palestine. They're still fighting for their independence and their recognition around the world. So although Israel maintains a brutal military occupation, the Palestinians have not lost, so to speak. They are still fighting back with a lot of difficulty and clearly a lot of obstacles in their path. So it's a murky picture, but I think people should be aware this in some ways is what Israel increasingly sees itself as doing on the international stage, which I think is really disturbing.
One company referred to as Black Cube, C-U-B-E, which seems to be especially nefarious and is compromised because it has former Mossad operatives in it. The NSO Group and Candaroo are other companies. Both Goldman Sachs and Blackstone have invested in the former. Who are these companies and what potential crimes have they been complicit with that can be documented, and how important has Wall Street investment been for their success? And if Wall Street has been at all influential in the amount of money they've given these companies, do they not bear some moral responsibility for the outcome of what is created by these companies?
Well, to answer your last question, sadly, yes, Wall Street has definitely invested hugely in many of these companies. And in fact, just today I read that last year, 2018, Israeli intelligence and cybersecurity companies reached for the first time over $1 billion of investment, which makes it the second biggest size industry in the world after the US. And you can be rest assured, and they listed some of the individuals and companies that were investing here in these companies. Wall Street is not the only people, but it's a big part of it. And so they undeniably have a great deal of responsibility. Just to give listeners a bit of a brief sense of what these companies have been doing, some people may have heard of Black Cube because Black Cube's got a bit of press in the US in the last year or so. A few quick examples. One, the disgraced Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein, who's obviously facing multiple sexual assault charges in an American court at the moment, hired Black Cube a few years ago to go after some of the women who were accusing him of sexual assault to try to get information about them, to essentially spy on them. This only came out, I might say, after his whole story was exposed. They've also, Black Cube, worked in Romania and Hungary with governments there, quite repressive governments, to try to foment opposition to any kind of dissent. They have also, Black Cube, worked, and this is a bit of a murky case, although it's been reported in other press, apart from where I said, and reported in my story, but they were working against individuals in the Obama administration who were making the deal with Iran, which, of course, the Trump administration has now reversed, and to try to spy and get information about senior officials who were key players in that Iran nuclear deal on the American side. NSO Group, people can Google this quite easily. There's been a great deal of evidence and information published in the last few months in my story and elsewhere of who they're selling this equipment to. Now, if you ask the company themselves, they don't give you much information. But there's been a range of other ways to find out exactly who they're selling it to. And it is some of the most repressive regimes in the world, but also some countries such as Mexico, which is, on one hand, quite repressive. On the other hand, not necessarily the country that one thinks about when you think of most repressive in the world. They've been using the Mexican government. The New York Times broke this last year, using NSO group technology to spy on critics and dissidents. Many other governments have been doing that. Many other governments around the world have used NSO group's technology to spy and LGBT people, to also accuse dissidents of not being Muslim, which in a Muslim country, a very conservative Muslim country, can be very, very problematic and can risk people's lives. Of course, when you ask the company, if you ask the Israeli government what they'll say about their work, they will say, we're abiding by all international laws and we're abiding by Israeli law. The problem is that the mechanism by which these companies are granted permission to sell this equipment here in Israel is incredibly lax, to put it mildly. And there's not really a great deal of checks and balances, because ultimately, as in many other countries' defense sectors, what matters is money and influence. Ethics have nothing to do with it. And I think exposing some of these companies to both public attention, but also the possibility of economic sanction and legal sanction, particularly legal sanction in the US and elsewhere, I think is important. And I do think in the coming months and years, you will see a lot of these companies facing some serious legal cases in various courts around the world, and I welcome that.
Can you speak on the use of spyware on Khashoggi's murder? And you just mentioned Harvey Weinstein, and you mentioned Obama, but nothing that we've been told about Khashoggi's murder makes any reasonable sense when our entire policy is supposed to be we will not do business with nor relate to known murderers, people who violate human rights. And yet even today, all the women who protested the women's ability to drive in Saudi Arabia all have been arrested, waterboarded, sexually assaulted, harassed, beaten, and they're still in captivity. And yet you wouldn't know this from the American media, nor from our administration, State Department, Defense Department, or White House, because we do business. So what message does it send to the world that we're willing to do anything if you put a dollar in our pocket? We don't care. We'll overlook murder, assassination in Yemen, genocide, and we're complicit in that. The American taxpayer pays for all those bombs and planes and satellite and even boots on the ground and supports the blockade. The United States government officially does. What does that say about we, the people of the United States?
It's very ugly, isn't it? There's no other way to see that. It's very, very ugly. And although you're absolutely right that the Trump administration has been unbelievably almost, there's actually a side of the Trump administration's response to the Khashoggi murder, which is, I actually quite appreciate. Let me explain what I mean by that. Appreciate that Trump himself and his administration are kind of being brutally honest. The U.S. relationship with Saudi has been dirty for years. And sadly, even if Khashoggi had been killed when Obama was president, Obama may well have given stronger speeches or been more critical publicly. But I can assure you privately, the deals that Saudi made with the Obama administration at the time were the biggest arms deal between those countries in history, the biggest by far. Over $100 billion. Trump obviously has tried to beat that in the last few years. But you're absolutely correct that the message that it sends to the world is, and to dictators and other leaders, is you can murder and get away with it, essentially, if you are a friend of ours or you are seen as friendly towards us. And one of the angles of this story that doesn't get enough attention and has been reported here and there is that one of the reasons, amongst many, that the Trump administration continued to blindly support the Saudis was because of Israeli influence and pressure behind the scenes for this one very key reason. One of the many appalling outcomes of the 2003 US-led war in Iraq has been, of course, a splintering and destruction of vast parts of the Middle East, not just Iraq, and the ascendancy of Iran. And Iran, for a variety of reasons, scares Saudi, it scares the Israelis and many other Arab states. And there's now almost an unofficial alliance that is building between horrible dictatorships in the Middle East, so we're talking about Saudi and others, and Israel. Now, obviously, officially, Israel and Saudi have no relationship, officially. They have no diplomatic relationships on the table publicly, but privately, they do increasingly, and the common enemy here is Iran. And it's a really revealing situation where a country like Israel, which talks about being the Middle East's only democracy, which I would actually question, but nonetheless, that's what it claims publicly, is befriending one of the most brutal regimes on the planet, which is Saudi Arabia. The Khashoggi murder was obviously shocking, and we still don't know a lot of details around it, apart from the fact that, of course, he was brutally murdered and possibly dismembered within the embassy itself, or consulate, I should say, in Istanbul in Turkey. And the technology that was used, as I said before, to document and find where he was going to be seems almost certainly now, thanks to Israeli government-sponsored, provided surveillance technology sold to the Saudis last year, to the tune of $250 million. And I think you are going to see, as I said, a court case here in Israel this year trying to essentially put pressure on and try to hold to account the Israeli company that was complicit in that. Sadly, history would suggest that the Israeli courts, not always, but mostly, side with the Israeli state and Israeli technology companies because they bring in so much revenue to the Israeli government every year. But I think it's important that court case moves forward because at least it brings attention of what kind of companies Israel is developing here with the experience, as I keep on bringing up because it's so relevant, after 50-plus years of occupation of Palestine. That's the kind of experience that it brings to the table.
It seems that countries that are most interested in Israel's surveillance are using it to hunt down dissidents. Our entire country was founded by dissidents. The Revolutionary War was fought because of dissidents, those who fought against the crown, George III. How widespread is this now where countries are going after whistleblowers, going after people that are telling the truth, who are uncovering crimes? Now, think of that just for a moment, Anthony. The people who are uncovering crimes are now treated as if they were the criminals, and the people who committed the crimes are never tried for anything.
That's absolutely right. And I know in the US and many other countries now there is a great deal of anger towards many people in the media. And I'm not here to defend everyone in the media, I can assure you, even though I'm a journalist myself. I have a lot of problems with a lot of the mainstream press as well, I can assure people listening. But having said that, in many countries around the world, the danger, the physical danger to journalists, not just journalists, dissidents, critics, artists, is never been greater. And in fact, last year, 2018, all the figures show that there were more journalists kidnapped and killed at any time in the modern era. This is not just in war zones. Obviously, you'd expect, although it's devastating, but you'd expect that to be happening in places like Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, Yemen, those sort of awful war zones in the Middle East. But I'm also talking about various other countries around the world where not just, but partly Israeli technology is being bought and used by horrible regimes to monitor and attack critics, dissidents, writers, artists, as I said before. And that does concern me greatly, both as a writer myself and a journalist, but also because I think what many leaders around the world see when they hear Donald Trump and many people around him talking about how it's fun to hit journalists, how it's okay to denigrate the media, how it's okay to say that they're enemy of the people, when dissidents in countries like Egypt and Saudi Arabia are disappeared, killed or tortured, Trump administration comes out the next day and hugs that leader or puts out a statement saying what a wonderful leader President al-Sisi is, who's the leader of Egypt, or the dictatorship in Saudi Arabia. That's the kind of message which is heard loud and clear around the world by many, many dictatorships. And again, I don't want to idealize how it was before Trump came into power. There were clearly profound hypocrisies going on during the Obama years and before that, to be sure. But Trump, in some ways, has become far more brazen in articulating a worldview which is very much about the good guys and the bad guys, and the good guys are our friends, even though they may be dictators and autocrats, and we'll sell them weapons and excuse if they murder a dissident or critic in an embassy somewhere. So I do think that there is a very dangerous environment going on in many places around the world that I visit as a writer and a journalist, and I speak to people regularly in my job, do a lot of this investigative reporting, and people often are scared because they don't have faith that their own government will protect them. That's often bad enough. But they also worry that often the US government or other Western governments also won't come to their aid, whether it's rhetorically or something more, if something happens, if they disappear. And that's why I think many of us who use smartphones, which is pretty much a lot of people these days, if we are communicating via WhatsApp or Signal or whatever communication we use on our phones, whether it's Android or iPhone, be very aware of the fact that a lot of our communication these days is not just easily hacked into, but probably monitored. Now, I'm not saying every single listener to your show is having their WhatsApp messages stored and kept and listened to every day by a US official. That's not probably happening. But I do know, and the Khashoggi case proves this, that WhatsApp is not a secure communication device anymore, sadly, and other communication apps might be the same. Many of us journalists often kind of joke that the most secure way to communicate through a pen and paper, back to the good old days. Now, obviously, that's kind of not really feasible in some ways in terms of how we communicate these days in the online connected era. But there's a degree of truth to it, that be very aware that online communication these days can never be 100% secure.
How flexible is Israel's spy technology? Does it have applications that would be of interest to the Silicon Valley tech companies like Google or Twitter or Microsoft or Facebook? And do you have any knowledge of these Israeli surveillance companies working with Silicon Valley firms?
It's interesting you say that. I mean, certainly there is a tight relationship between the Israeli technology companies and various Silicon Valley companies, the ones you mentioned and others. I don't know off the top of my head any, for example, these companies, NSO Group or Black Cube or others, being funded or backed or bought by Facebook or Google or anything like that. But let's be clear that Amazon, as one example, Jeff Bezos, the owner of Amazon, the richest man in the world, the man who owns the Washington Post, works closely on storage and cloud computing with the CIA. That's not a secret. It's easily, people can Google that and find that very easily. Now, that sort of stuff to me is deeply concerning. So on the one hand, you have an individual like that with vast power who owns Amazon, an incredibly powerful company, who runs the Washington Post, an incredibly powerful newspaper organization around the world, but also at the same time is working with the CIA and other intelligence companies to surveil people, monitor people, amongst other things. That is a real worry to me. And I think what's happened in the last 20 or so years is that many people around the world have allowed the so-called deluded belief that companies like Apple and Google, most companies that many of us now can't live without in some ways, believe that they're somehow utopian, that they're looking for our better selves, when in fact they're corporations aiming to make a profit. And that's hardly a revelation to say that. But too often, I think that's changing a little bit in the last year or two with scandal after scandal engulfing Facebook, for example. But the question is ultimately, what's the US government and the US Congress, for example, going to do about it? The EU, thankfully, is trying to some extent to put some kind of restrictions on the power of companies like Facebook and Google. In my view, it should be much stronger, but they're at least making a start. The US Congress so far has done kind of virtually nothing. They kind of haul Facebook officials in front of Congress and ask them some tough questions, if that, and they kind of walk away and that's it.
And those are dog and pony shows. We're famous for politicians acting as if they're concerned in a committee only to use their little outtakes in their campaigns. They do it purely
Indeed.
For political gain and for virtue signaling. Look how virtuous
totally.
I am. Instead
yes.
of what they don't do diddly squat. You know, you would have more integrity in a brothel in Belgium than you would in our entire United States Congress. That's how much contempt I hold for these punks. But that's me personally. And my last question is simple. We seem incapable politically and economically of ever being critical of anything Israel does. I fully expect Israel to bomb or start a campaign against Iran now that they know they'll have the full backing of the United States. I fully expect that all of their crimes of spying illegally against American government offices and people will never be revealed. Do you have any indication to what degree Israel conducts intelligence operations on its own secretly in the United States? And I'm sure that all of our National Security Agency and employees at the top, as well as CIA, are fully aware of this, and yet they're allowed to spy on us and not a mention of this.
Yes, the short answer is yes, that there is a vast Israeli spy network in the U.S. And in fact, now and then you sort of hear some official inadvertently acknowledge this, and then sort of the story disappears. For sure, it's happening. It's common. And in fact, if we're talking, as an example, about the unhealthily close relationship between Israel and the U.S., the last 2 years, America's been consumed, obviously, by the supposed collusion between the Trump administration and Russia. I think a lot of that is maybe more smoke than fire, but nonetheless, there's obviously something going on there, and we may find out more soon. And that's obviously, I'm not dismissing the possibility that Trump worked with the Russians, but I think a lot of it at the moment is not entirely proven. Having said that, what's really, really worrying to me, which gets virtually no coverage, is there has been profound collusion between Israel and the Trump administration after he won office, before he actually took power in January 2017 in relation to a UN vote about Israeli settlements. There's been some reporting about this. Listeners can Google that and find out something about it, but it hasn't got much press. And that, to me, is collusion. That's what collusion means. One of the things I think that has slightly changed in the US, and that gives me a sliver, not much, but a sliver of optimism, is that there is a shift going on in parts of a Democratic Party and within the American Jewish community and in the wider community about Israel. Now, yes, if you read most of the mainstream press, you don't get much of the sense of this, to be sure. But, for example, a handful of new Congress people who were elected late last year in your country are very critical of Israel. They get a lot of press. That, to me, is a positive sign. It's possible to have a degree of discussion about should a country be allowed to boycott Israel? Should Israel be allowed to receive all this money and aid every year if it commits war crimes against Palestinians? That's a change. And in the American Jewish community, there is undeniably a growing generational split between many, many young Jews, more liberal Jews, who are so profoundly disgusted with how Israel behaves. And when you grow up Jewish, as I did, you're sort of told that Israel speaks for us and it's a Jewish state, and therefore we have to support it uncritically. And many people obviously accept that to an extent. But that's now changing. And after 50 years of occupation, this is not surprising. I mean, this is what's going to happen. You're going to have a corruption of a Jewish community if you believe that your role as a Jew is to uncritically support an occupying country such as Israel. So that's a shift. Now, politically, it has not had a great deal of effect in the halls of power in Washington yet. But at least I'm holding on to some degree of hope that I think in years to come that will start to change to an extent. And if and when the relationship between Israel and the U.S. shifts, it's only going to happen because of grassroots power in the U.S. and other countries around the world. I know, having lived here in Jerusalem on and off for a number of years, that many Jewish dissidents and Israeli dissidents here will say that without outside pressure, whatever that looks like, the situation here between Israel and Palestine will never change.
Well, I appreciate you being on today. I'm sure you're fully aware that you are going to be under constant surveillance because you're an outspoken critic with your documentaries, with your writings, your books. Have you had direct threats against you, or have you seen things you would otherwise have no problem doing interrupted because of your position?
I think the less said about that, the better. But I guess I'll just suffice to say that, yes, I'm aware that critics are often targeted, and, yes, I've had threats over the years, and I'm aware of it. But on a range of issues, whether it's Israel-Palestine or the war on terror or whatever it may be, I think it's important that journalists investigate and speak out, and I like to think that there's a community out there in various parts of the world that will support that. So, yes, but I am not, I'm not naive, put it that way. I'm not naive. I'm aware of the threats.
Well, thank you very much, Anthony, for being on. My guest, Anthony Lowenstein, his current book is My Israel Question, and also we had him on years ago for Disaster Capitalism, Making a Killing Out of Catastrophe, and his website is anthonylowenstein.com. Thank you, Anthony, for being on today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying.